The final consideration, why it is that physicians nowadays commonly do not work with the simple reading of the Gemara, that if you're standing by the bedside of someone as they as their neshama departs, it would be appropriate to tear kriya. And Rav Shechter offered a very interesting insight. A little bit earlier in the Gemara, we saw that there's a certain window of time when kriya for a relative is appropriate. It has to be any time from the passing of the individual, ideally before up until the burial. Once the burial is complete, it's no longer what we call a shas chimam. Literally, shas chimam means a time of heat, of emotion, of more more poignant response. If for whatever reason the person didn't perform kriya to that at that point, so anytime during the shiva or even during the shloshim, as plan B, it's still acceptable to perform the kriya. After shloshim, I don't think the person would still do kriya, if they're already aware of the death for 30 days. But the ideal time is in that window between the death and the burial. That's the shas chima. That's the primary time. We saw an expression of that the last one that we stopped with. Abaye told the chachamim in the Beis Medrash that you should wait, once they learned of their obligation to tear kriya upon the passing of Rav Safra, they were told, wait until the hesped, and then you'll tear kriya at the time of hesped. Don't just do it, in the middle of the street, in the middle of the day, because it should be in response to the emotions that are evoked. So Shechter said, a physician who's in the hospital all day and can have, unfortunately, a number of patients who can pass in the course of a given number of hours, it's hard to say that such a person, because they're exposed to it, unfortunately, so much, is going to have the same emotional response as they would if, someone who encounters it rarely. Other people around the table, other people around the bed would still be obligated to tear kriya, but the physician, for him, it just doesn't bring about the same emotional response. And that could be the reason why we're makil, and a proof to that could be a Gemara in Sanhedrin. We mentioned last week that as evidence from the story of the Meraglim, when they bring back a bad report about Eretz Yisrael, Yehoshua and Kalev hear the report and they tear kriya. So we said that anytime there's something blblasphemous that someone witnesses, again, maybe not anything, but something, in that hierarchy of such news, then kriya is to be performed. But the Gemara says that nowadays, if you're walking down the street and you hear a non-Jew cursing God, we don't tear kriya. Why? Because otherwise, all of our clothing would be torn. That's what the Gemara says. The Gemara says that it's just something which it doesn't evoke the same response, because you can walk down, you can go into the subway, and it just sort of more in the environment, than we can tolerate and still maintain the same response to. So that's an interesting corollary of what we're saying. And the other loose end that I wanted to tie up was regarding Tzahal. So the question came to Rav Goren. Rav Goren was chief rabbi, and he was the chief rabbinic figure for Tzahal for many years. And he was asked, what if a chayal hears about the loss of a relative? Should he tear his uniform? And Rav Goren said yes. Rav Goren said yes. Because we spoke about it just briefly last week. What's halacha if you're wearing borrowed clothing? If you're wearing borrowed clothing and you attend the funeral. So it depends. Did you ask the person? Did you inform them that you might be going to a place where you'd have to tear kriya? If they're aware of it, then you do tear kriya even though the clothing don't belong to you. However, this is the key. The person has to compensate whomever they borrowed the shirt from for the torn shirt. Okay? So, interestingly enough, Goren said you should tear kriya and you should pay back the Israeli government, you should pay back the military for the torn uniform. Because otherwise, if you don't pay for it, then you don't really feel the same. It's interesting. Kriya is, in yeshiva terms, we would say it's a maisa kriya. The mitzvah is performed simply by doing the action. It's more than that. If you don't have to pay for, if you're not suffering a loss, a monetary loss through the destruction of that garment, then you haven't fully fulfilled the mitzvah. Okay? That was a response of Rav Goren. And Rav Nevensal, along similar lines, also said that if there was an individual, he was asked about a chayal who's standing, on the front lines, and another soldier unfortunately is killed. So Rav Nevensal said two reasons why you shouldn't have to. The main reason we said last week, I think, was that you shouldn't tear kriya, because then soldiers are going to run away from the scene of fallen soldiers when really they need their help. Similar to what we saw in the Geshra Chaim Svara, why doctors don't tear kriya, because that would discourage a Hatzalah worker or first responder from being where they need to be, knowing that they're going to have to tear their clothing. Okay, that was just a finish up last week. That was also the stall, so everyone would make it here. We're ready to begin the Gemara. Our goal today is to try to make it down to the bottom of the page. Chaf Heyom and Alv, if I seem to be going on too many tangents, feel free to kick me under the table. You're more than welcome. We've got to keep moving and covering ground. There's a lot to learn. Baruch Hashem. We are on the fifth wide line. Chaf Heyom and Alv, 25A. Fifth wide line. The first word on the line is Behespedo, and we're going to pick up after that. I'm just going to mute the audience at home. Okay. Chav Heyom and Aleph, Kinach Nafshe, the Rav Huna, when Rav Huna passed away, Sovar Lo Suve, Sever Torah Apurye, initially, those who were orchestrating the events at the funeral suggested that we should take a Sefer Torah, and we should place the Sefer Torah upon his bed, upon the mita, upon the aron that he was being carried out in. That was the original idea. Why? What's the significance of that? You know, it was some sort of ornament, very unusual. So Rashi says it's the first narrow line, lo suvi Sefer Torah apurye. Why were they going to place the Sefer Torah on his bed? The lomar kiem zeh mashakasu bezeh. Because that would call people's attention, and the statement would be made that this individual, Rav Huna, fulfilled everything in this Torah. Everything in the Sefer Torah. Tremendous kavod. Tremendous kavod. Where do we find that was done? We're going to see in a few seconds. The Gemara rejects that. They didn't go through with that plan. But we do find the Gemara Bava Kam at the end of the first parak, Chizkiyo HaMelech. Chizkiyo HaMelech was given this unique honor where they placed the Sefer Torah on his mita as they carried him out. And we'll see the difference between the two in a moment. So Amar Lo Rav Chizda. Rav Chizda said, a Sefer Torah... Yeah, so Kisvei HaKodesh, they're matame yadayim. They make your hands tame. Your hands tame.
That's what they're
upon. Right, right. That's so that people don't put food. It's one of the deal. So you don't put food near the scroll because then mice would come and eat the food and then would eat away at the Sefer Torah also.
But that question came up, Rabbi, about a woman who's a nida. Could she carry one? So I don't see the problem, but I'm opposed to.
Okay, so Rashi records that issue, but it's not a question of becoming tame. In the classic sense. Mm-hmm. So this was not a concern of Tuma. What the Gemara is saying, there was something else involved over here. What was involved over here, we're in Bavel right now. This story is happening in Bavel. Everyone was Tame. Right. This was long after the, you know, when we were really concerned about that. Chizkiyo, on the contrary, the Gemara says at the time of Chizkiyo, I believe, the proliferation of Torah was so great, you could even ask little kids, you know, and they were proficient in the most complicated dinim of Tumah V'Taharah during his time. And that's exactly, you helped me jump the gun, Tosfos over there in Bava Kama asked the question, how come we see Rav Hamnuna was not treated with that kavod and Chizkiyo was? Chizkiyo was on a level way beyond Rav Hamnuna, Rav Huna was a great Amora, but Chizkiyo was actually buried right near David and Shlomo. Okay, just to give you a sense of where, you know, where he was holding. He was a king, obviously, but he was given greater kavod than even Rav Huna over here. But there's another consideration. The Gemara doesn't even go into the tomb. It doesn't even go into the propriety. The question of the propriety is it really right to say that this individual fulfilled everything here in the Torah? Should we have the boldness to make such a statement? That might be a little bit risky. We don't want to overdo it. In a hesped, you have to be careful. It says in Shulchan Aruch, you have to elaborate and enumerate whatever positive qualities there are about the niftar, but that also can't be overdone because that ultimately detracts and cheapens the words, and it cheapens, people are going to be murmuring to themselves, oh, come on, that's not really true about the person who, then you're actually counterproductive in your hesped. Right? This is the concern. The Gemara continues. Right? Amar Lo Rav Chizda, Milsa de Bechai lo svir lei, Hashta lekum lei, Lavid lei? Something that Rav Huna would never allow in his own lifetime, you're going to do in his death? What does that mean? Da'am Rav Tachlifa, Anach Aziz lo Rav Huna. Rav Tachlifa says he once saw his Rebbe Rav Huna. Deboi lemeis vapuria, he wanted to sit down on a bed. They didn't always sit on chairs. Sometimes they would sit on a bed. They would eat on their beds. Va'hava manach sefer Torah lei. There was a sefer Torah on the bed, so he couldn't sit down. So what did he do? The kaf kada, a pitcher. Probably wasn't like a pitcher that you have water. If you go to the Israel Museum and they have the display where they found the Dead Sea Scrolls, you know, they had the huge pottery, you know, maybe like 3-4 feet tall, right? So this was, let's say, a large kli. Kaf kada a'ara. He turned it over on the ground. And he was able to balance, or he was able to place the Sefer Torah. That's what I'm emphasizing. It was a larger kli that it was appropriate to put the Sefer Torah on top of. So he was makbid not to sit on the bed, and instead he found an appropriate place for it on top of this kli. The Gemara continues, Alma kasavar asur leishev al gabi mita she Sefer Torah munachaleh. Rav Huna was obviously of the opinion that you're not allowed to sit on a Sefer, on a bed where the Sefer Torah is also resting. Okay, so end of story. They scrap that idea. They're not going to put the Sefer Torah on the bed because otherwise, that you know, Rav Huna himself wouldn't stand for that when he was alive, as is evidenced by the story. Now you might say to yourself, you look at the story, like, of course you don't sit on a bed with the Sefer Torah. So believe it or not, it's a Gemara in Menachos where there's a disagreement about this. But there are a few exceptions. There is a little room for leniency. If you take a look at Tosfos at the top, first Tosfos. Kaf kada ara v'anach alei sefer Torah. That's the story we just read. He turned the kad upside down. He put the sefer Torah on top. V'nira dafilu ha-sefer Torah munach b'gavoa mimenu lo shari. He says, even if the sefer Torah is elevated, it's munach b'gavoa. It's a little bit higher than where you're sitting. So it's balanced. Let's say there's a box or something on the bed and the sefer Torah is on top of the bed. Lo shari is still not okay to sit on the bed. Why? Very simple. Midelo osvuha lesefer Torah begavo mimeno. Logical deduction. Rav Huna could have done that. Why did Rav Huna have to find something else to put on the floor and turn upside down and put the sefer Torah on that? He should have just found something, just shifted it over, you know, a little bit, and instead of going through all this trouble, if in fact it was permissible to put it at that slightly elevated height on the bed. That is the opinion of Tosfos. There's a Yerushalmi explicitly that says it's mutter to sit on the bed with the Sefer Torah if the Sefer Torah is elevated, let's say for sure, one tefach or three tefach. There's a disagreement about how high it has to be, but it's clear in the Yerushalmi that it's okay. Tosfos looks at this Gemara and says the Bavli disagrees with the Yerushalmi. But I think the more accepted opinion, many Rishonim, some say the Rambam holds like this as well, are of the opinion that if it is elevated, it is permissible. The only question is how high does it have to be? Ideally, 10 tefachim. 10 tefachim is about 3 or 4 feet, again, off the, you know, the bed level, okay? But the Shach says even if it's only one tefach, strictly speaking, that would still be acceptable. If you had nothing else to, no else to place the Sefer Torah. If it's either a Sefer Torah on the floor or the Sefer Torah on the chair or the bed and raised up by a tefach, 3-4 inches, that's okay. So, you know, again, to various degrees, the more you can do, the better. But even one tefach would be sufficient. When I was growing up in the Young Israel of West Hempstead, if anyone knows the layout of the main shul there. So the main shul, they have these long benches that like 50, 60 feet long going from one end, you know, to the other. So it was always like this fight in the shul because you'd walk into shul and like 30 feet down the aisle, there were siddurim that were propped up. So a minhag developed to, you know, instead of removing the book, the sefer, the chumash altogether, they would prop it up upright. Strictly speaking, that's not really enough because you're still sitting on the same bench, the same level as the sefer. However, I saw today Rav Yashiv Paskin that if you're short on space, and if the other alternatives, I'm going to have to keep getting up and down and putting it over here, putting it over there. I want to learn from the sefer, and I've seen Talmidei Chacham do this, you know, and put the sefer over here and then open up another sefer. If it's for the purposes of the learning, there's room to be makil, because that's also covered for the sefer. If it's going to allow for further study, especially we have certain kulas, our printed svarim don't have the same kedusha in some scenarios than the classic written scrolls that they were using. Again, this is a bigger topic, but there's definitely room to be makil when there is a great need to do so. Okay, let's continue.
Curious, yeah. Tefillin, let's say, is there a problem?
Tefillin is similar to Sefer Torah. Tefillin, yeah, it has the full kedusha. Yeah, so we, you know, the difference with the tefillin is it's probably going to be in a case. You know, you usually don't just leave your tefillin out like that. But again, ideally you should elevate it to some degree or find somewhere else to put it when possible. We definitely try to do the best we can. Okay. I assume that was the thinking when they refurbished the Young Israel of Hillcrest. You know, everyone has their own bucket seats, you know, in the theater. So, you know, you can always make sure there's plenty of space to put your svarim. Okay. Let's continue. So the Gemara now has a very interesting detail of the story where towards the end of the line, Lo have enoughic puria. The first word of the line is puria. Okay, end of the line, going on to the beginning. The next line, lo have enoughic puria mibava. His puria is a bed. Okay, it also means Purim. Okay, but chayv inish lepsumei bepuria bepuraya. Okay, but a puria is a bed. They couldn't get it out from the bava, right? Bava is a gate. Bava is an entrance, like bava kama, bava metzia, bava basra, three different gates. So they couldn't get his bed out of the front door where he was lying. Savar lishol shule derech gagin. So they thought, okay, we can't take it out the regular way. We'll lower him like on ropes derech gagin. We'll take him out through the through a window or some elevation, and then we'll lower him down to get him out of the house. Amar lo Rav Chisda. I have a tradition from Rav Huna. Right? These are all the Talmidim are standing around the bedside of the Rebbe, and they're weighing in on the proper procedure based on what they learned from Rav Huna himself. So Gamirna Mine, I learned from Rav Huna, Chacham Kvodo Derech Pesach. Chacham Kvodo Derech Pesach. The only appropriate way to give proper respect to the Chacham is that when you are taking his body out to burial, you should bring him out the door. Okay, it seems pretty sensible. You know, to take him out through some unusual fashion would be, there'd be a whole pachki. It's not kavadik. So they said, okay, we got to get him out at the door. That's our objective. So let's find another bed that's a little more narrow that'll fit through the door. Amar lahu Rav Chisda. Rav Chisda again weighed in and said, Hachi gemir minei. I heard something else from Rav Huna. He taught us, Chacham kvodo b'mita rishona. The Chacham, appropriate kavod is to only bring a Talmud Chacham out on the original bed in which he's lying. Okay, now parenthetically, nowadays we're not so makbid about this. And the reason is because whatever bed he was on, right, could be, in the old days, they just took that bed and they put him into the ground. They didn't necessarily have a mita at all. We have more prescribed, standardized, procedure for burying the mace. We have to put them in an aron, right? So we have to move the mace into the appropriate aron. That's a din. The way we bury in the coffin and the specific coffins that we use, that's prescribed by halacha. I think we mentioned this the other couple of weeks ago. Used to be they had fancy caskets, and then it was getting too expensive, so the poor people couldn't afford to live up to the expectation. So they would just leave their mace without proper burial. So therefore, it was mandated by Rabbi Gamliel. Everyone has to use the same simple Pasha casket.
Does that have any relevance to why the minhag is we take a person right off the bed and put him on the floor? Is anything to do
I don't
with
think
that
so. I don't think that's a Kabbalistic idea. That's a good point. It's a good point because it doesn't seem to be acknowledged over here. It doesn't seem to be acknowledged over here. It's a good point. I have to think about that. Many of those minhagim are, we only have them on the books in the last several hundred years. Many of the minhagim, even though they could go back a very, very long time, they were never really recorded. The more Kabbalistic procedures.
Someone said the reason you put them on the floor is the floor is cold, keeps the body cool.
Okay, that's an important. Okay, that could be.
Reason then,
right.
Ballistic, but
that's interesting.
Everything else ever Kadisha does, you can't find in a sefer anywhere. I asked because I was on one first one. Mm-hmm. So I asked Rabbi Gamliel, he said nowhere.
There's a sefer called Mavar Yabok. A couple hundred years ago, a Kabbalistic sefer that records a lot of the minhagim. But you're right. By and large, we don't have as much on the books.
What?
What's that?
Tanya.
Okay. You have to ask your children and Motsi. I don't know. Okay. So. Okay. I don't think he talks about this so much. So Chacham Kvodu B'mita Rishona. So don't switch him to another bed because it's not appropriate. You bury him, you take him out in the same bed that he was put in. Okay, so here's a lamda shashayla. What if without this whole conversation, they switched the beds. They switched the beds. Okay, someone who was unaware of this hakpad, of this particular behavior, he switched him to another bed. He thought he was doing the right thing. And then we noticed it. What should be the right thing to do? Should we transfer him back to the first bed? Or should we just leave him in the bed that he's already in? Okay. So wonderful, Batal. So why would you say it? Why would you say leave him in the bed he's already in?
Because you want to have derech eretz.
Oh, so Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach asked one question. What should this question depend upon? The question should depend upon the following: is the concept of derech eretz over here, Batal, that you're pointing to very, very accurately? The concept of derech eretz that you leave the mace in the mita, is it the pshat that it would be a lack of kavod to switch him? Or is it that the proper kavod is that he should be in the first bed? That makes sense? Meaning, what exactly are we looking for? Is it the pshat that he should remain in the original bed because the original bed is unique and has some sort of designation to it? Or no, the pshat is don't transfer him. The nafkamina, the ramifications would be, once you've already transferred him, does it make sense to transfer him back? right? Only if the first mita has some significance to it, or, but like you said, no, don't transfer him to another bet, right? What did you say? You said you should transfer him back?
No, leave him where he is.
Leave him where he is, because if the chisaron, if the lack of kavod stems from the transfer, so then exactly what you said, Bitzal, okay? So we, that's an unresolved question, but I love the question because every line in the Gemara, first of all, there's no such thing as a story. I'm sorry, I'm on a tangent. You can kick me in 30 seconds. Did we talk about the pots and pans? We spoke about the pots and pans, right? That the Rav said that Reb Chaim brought Yoredeya out of the kitchen. And before Reb Chaim came along, it was just pots and pans, because it was just the shilas that the rabbi needed to know to answer about conscience. If someone, a little bit of milk falls into the chicken soup. What that really means is that there's no area of Torah, there's not a single line of the Gemara that lacks the same sophistication of the most complicated sugyas in Yevamos. That if HaKadosh Baruch Hu wrote that part of Torah Shabbat Peh, he wrote this part of Torah Shabbat Peh as well. And we can analyze and we can pick apart the nitty-gritty and the wisdom in every single line, even if it just sounds like a story of a bunch of people sitting around the room trying to get a mace out to the mace HaKfaris. And I love thinking about that because it just, it elevates our understanding, our appreciation on an intellectual level and on a metaphysical level of how significant what we're doing is. It's not just a story. You just need to be trained to look a little more deeply. And Shlomo Zalman said, even in this detail that seems unimportant, there's what to analyze. Okay, and we continue. The Gemara says, so you can't transfer him to another bed. To Amar Yehuda, Amar Rav. Now, so what's the basis for that, right? Where does this concept, how do we know that this is what engenders Derech Eretz? Or maybe Bitzal, with all due respect, maybe it's not Derech Eretz at all. Minayin l'chacham shekvodo b'mita rishona. What is the basis for this particularity of keeping the mace in the first location, the first bed? Shenemar v'yarkivu es aron huelokim el agola chadasha. Okay, so what is this pasuk? They transported the aron of Hashem. This is the aron kodesh on the new wagon. Okay, so the background of the story is this is Sefer Shoftim. And the Aron Kodesh had been captured by the Plishtim. It went out to war. I'm sorry, Shmuel. Sorry, yes, Shmuel. Right at the beginning of Shmuel Aleph is when it's captured, and it hangs out by the Plishtim for quite a while. And the Plishtim suffer terrible maladies and disasters and catastrophes. And finally, they say, "All right, it's time to give it back. This is not working out. Clearly, the gods are not happy, or the God is not happy. We should say." So they send it back to the Jewish people. It also went from house to house a little bit along the way, but it ended up at a place called Beis Aminadav. Aminadav was the person who was watching the Aron at the time. And eventually, as time went on, David HaMelech called for the Aron to be brought to Ir David, which you can go visit nowadays, the archaeological area.
Obed Edom,
right? There was a few different stops.
And then, you know, his house was blessed and
he got all kinds of brachos, right, okay.
They weren't happy with that the Levium weren't carrying it on stage.
Okay, so hold on. Maybe we'll get back to that, right? Because what's clear is that it was transported on a wagon. As Sam was pointing out, it says very clearly in the Torah, or it's even actually explicit in Navi as well, because if you sow, it's supposed to be carried specifically on the shoulders with the poles, right? And Aron Noses Nosav, they didn't even have to carry it. The Aron actually lifted and carried the people who were carrying it. But let's focus on the wagon. So this is the wagon. The Plishtim wanted to ascertain if the correct move was to return the Aron to the Jewish people. They put on a wagon, and they sort of sent the wagon off and watched it to see where it would end up. And lo and behold, the oxen, or it was actually, I think it was female cows, and the whole trick, they had to make sure that that they wouldn't be drawn after their mothers. Yes. And the wagons made it back to the Jews. Okay? So it says that the David HaMelech, when he wanted to transport the Aron, he used the same wagon that had been used to bring it back to the Jewish people in the first place. Okay? So continuing our parallel, our metaphor, the person, the Talmud Chacham, the Sefer Torah, the Aron Kodesh. So there's some lesson to be learned over here indicating that we should bring it back. We should leave the Chacham in the same bed upon which he was Niftar. Now, just as a side point, there's something very unusual in Rashi over here. Rashi says that this, Rashi basically, in short form, tells you what I just told you. This was the wagon that they got the Aron Kodesh back from the Plishtim. But if you remember the story in Shmuel, that wagon was actually, when it made its way back to the Jews, the Jews removed the Aron from the wagon, chopped it up, turned it into firewood for a mizbeach, And the cows that carry the wagon were brought as karbanos.
Right.
So the Achronim ask on Rashi, Rashi, don't you know the story? Doesn't Rashi know the story in Shmuel? Maybe we don't know, but at least Rashi should know it. So we're going to leave it open-ended. Think about it. Give you some food for thought over Thanksgiving. But Rashi's version of the story is very, very unusual because, again, the simple reading of the Pesukim indicate that agolo, that wagon, was chopped up into firewood. Mm. Okay? But be that as it may, we derive from that story that you keep the Aron, you keep the Chacham in its original location, and you don't transfer it to somewhere else. Okay? But as you said, there was some divine anger against David HaMelech because it probably should have been transported on the shoulders of the Levium. There is definitely a basis to suggest that Uzzah was the right. The Uzzah was a Levi, I believe, who was killed in the procession bringing the Aron Kodesh back towards David HaMelech. It seemed like it was slipping off the wagon, and he caught it, and he died on the spot because you get too close, you can get burned. But that may have all been the result of the fact that it wasn't being transported in the first place in a proper fashion. Okay, let's continue. So they're stuck there at the door. Everyone's scratching their head. You know, how many Talmidei Chacham does it take to get an Aron out of a house? And now they have a new idea. Pros Bava. They broke the door frame, the Avkuha, and they took out the bed. Okay, that was the only thing they could do. They had no other option. Pasuk Alei Rabbi Abba. So Rabbi Abba opened up. That's always a lashon, meaning he began the shir, or sometimes it means he began the hesped. Although we have to see, you know, it's not the right time for a hesped. You know, they're still trying to get him out the door to the makom where he's going to be buried. Pasuk Alei Rabbi Abba, Roy Hay Rabbeinu Shetishra Alav Shchina El Shebebavel Garmalai. The Rebbe, Rav Huna in this case, right? He truly should have merited to have the Shechina rest upon him because he was such a great Talmud Chacham. However, Bavel Garmalai, the fact that he lived in Bavel, the fact that he lived so far away from Eretz Yisrael and he lived in Golis, that prevented him from the full extent of the Shechina that he would otherwise have merited to enjoy. Okay? So what prompted this, you know, impromptu, so to speak, hesped, right? It's just a little out of place over here. So the Mefarshim say something very interesting. I think the Maratchiyah says, because, again, their parallel of the Talmud Chacham and the Aron Kodesh and the story of the wagon is not just, superficial. What do we know about the Aron? The Aron Kodesh in the Beis HaMikdash, Chazal say, Eino Min HaMinyan.
Eino Min HaOlam.
The dimensions of the Kodesh HaKadoshim were 10 by 10.
Yeah.
And but the Aron Kodesh should not have fit. But there was something supernatural about the Kodesh HaKadoshim that was L'mayla min hazman, L'mayla min hatevo, something above nature. The Kohen Gadol could still go in there and walk around, do whatever he had to do, even though spatially it defied, you know, physics. And so
the movie, the guy Steven Spielberg must have learned that better.
Raiders of the Lost Ark, Mamish, this Gemara, okay, you know. So it didn't make sense. It was able to, you know, just bend the rules. So he said, if not for Bavel, if not for the fact that Rav Huna lived in Bavel, his mita would have been able to make it through the doorway. Right? That was what was missing over here. He should have had the schus that the dimensions of the doorway wouldn't matter in the same way they didn't matter for the Aron Kodesh Beis HaMikdash. I think it's a beautiful pshat. Okay, Gemara continues. So they took him out. Now we're going to stop and analyze a little bit this last line about living in Bavel. Masiv Rav Nachman Bar Chizda, Va'amri lo Rav Chanan Bar Chizda. Again, they're standing around the bed at this time. And Rav Nachman asked the following question, or Rav Chanan asked the following question. Pasuk from Yecheskel. Hayo, hayo, devar Hashem al Yecheskel ben Buzi HaKoin be'eretz kastim. Sefer Yecheskel, the Nevuah opens up, this is right at the beginning of the Sefer, Perek Aleph, that Hashem speaks to Yecheskel. He gives him this vision. And he's in Eretz Kazim. Eretz Kazim, in English, the Chaldeans. That was Nebuchadnezzar, Bavel, right? That's where they went in the Golis after the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. The first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. So what do you mean? What's the big deal about being in Bavel? You can still receive Nevuah in Bavel. So what are you telling me about Rav Huna? So we're not going to talk about this, but definitely worth considering. Is this the kind of kasha you ask? Someone said something very positive about the Rebbe, you know, in front of the mita, in front of the mace, and you come and ask kasha. No, really, you know, I don't know. Maybe he wasn't so great. Maybe he should have had a nevuah in Bavel just like a Yecheskel. Okay, so something to think about. But clearly,
plus don't do it at the end. It has been
okay. So, so there must be an answer for this. We need to think about it. Okay, but he didn't get away with it so easily. Tofach le'avua b'sandal. His father was there, and he kicked him. Okay, Rashi says he kicked him under the table. You know, he tried to do it discreetly, so he, you know, he wasn't trying to embarrass him. But he, what kind of kasha are you asking? But this is the question that he said, Omerle, lava minalach, didn't I tell you, lo titrit alma, don't bother people with your kashas, okay? My hayas, he's giving an answer. He's explaining why that pasuk in Yecheskel is not relevant to the situation. My haya, this double lashon, right? The pasuk in Yecheskel said hayo haya. Mm-hmm. Right, what does the repetition indicate? Hayah shahayah kfar. Shahayah kfar. Yecheskel's right to Nevuah, Yecheskel's right to Nevuah in Bavel was by virtue of the fact that he had already experienced Nevuah when he was still in Eretz Yisrael. Yecheskel accompanied the people from Israel to Bavel in the Golus, and because he had experienced Nevuah already before they left Israel, so he was able to continue at that prophetic state. But if someone would be born in Bavel, that might be a different story. Okay, I have to add a few points over here because this is a fascinating discussion. Number one, I randomly picked up a sefer. The YU library is an overwhelmingly amazing place because there's a billion svarim there. So I was looking to see what they had in Moikud and see what new svarim had come out recently. And I fell in love with the sefer over here and I opened up the front and it turns out it was written by Rabbi Zakatinsky, who is in Kew Gardens Hills in Hashivenu, 137 68 75th Road. Okay, so if you know him, please send him my Hakaras HaTov. So he collects a little discussion about this issue of Nevu and Chutz La'aretz. So why should it be so difficult to have Nevu and Chutz La'aretz? If someone wants to talk to a human being, talk to a human being. By the way, that is the number 6, I believe, out of the 13 Animamins. That the way we have it, if you look in your Siddur, Animamin, I believe that all the words of the Nevi'im are true. But if you actually look on the Rambam, which is, you know, the we'll say the unabridged version, that the Animamins were, you know, were meant to summarize, the real tenet of belief is not simply that I believe that the words are true. I believe that God speaks to humans. I believe that a human being can reach the level that he can communicate with the divine. I think that takes it to a whole different level. I mean, we need to not just believe, okay, the words are correct, but we need to also have confidence in the potential of people to reach such a high level, because that also inspires us to whatever level we're able to reach. So just give one or two examples. The Sefer Ikrim, Rabbi Yosef Albo, very important philosophical work in the Middle Ages, he says that it's very simple. Eretz Yisrael is different than Chutz La'aretz, right? This is probably what we would have assumed, right? Eretz Yisrael, specifically, the Aron Elohim was in Eretz Yisrael, meaning there's a conduit by which God is able to communicate to man, and that is by virtue of the hashpa, of the influence, of the holiness of the Beis HaMikdash and the Aron Kodesh, and anyone in the environs are able to pick up a little bit from that. That's why we call it Simchas Beis HaShoeva. Simchas Beis HaShoeva was when everyone would come and have a big party in the Beis HaMikdash. So Chazal say, Shoeva, what does Shoeva mean? We usually, right, they would draw water and they would pour it in the Mizbeach. The Gemara says further, Chazal say, Mikan Sheshoevin Ruach HaKodesh. You wouldn't just draw the water from the well. You could draw upon the sources of divine inspiration when you attended the Simchas Beis HaShoeva in the Beis HaMikdash. Actually, it says that that's where Yonah gets this communication from God out of nowhere, right? That's how it begins. And Hashem spoke to Yonah. Where did that come from? He was at the Simchas Beis HaShoeva, okay? So make sure you plan accordingly. Next time you're at Yisrael, Sukkot time, that's where you want to be. So that's what the Sefer Ikrim says. The Kuzari says, no, it's more... There's just a propensity for greater spiritual heights in Eretz Yisrael. He doesn't tie it to the Beis HaMikdash and Aron Kodesh specifically, but that's where it's at. That's where you're going to connect better than anywhere else. The Rambam makes no mention of this limitation that our Gemara seems to impose. The Rambam seems to indicate by omission that you can get Nevuah even in Chutz La'aretz. You can get Nevuah in Chutz La'aretz. So what does he do with this Gemara? So he says the reason why there's no Nevuah in Chutz La'aretz, I have to ask one of our Kohanim over here. Who else a Kohen, right?
No.
No? Who else a Kohen? Only one Kohen. Okay, Mr. Galanto, why don't we duchen every day?
Two Kohanim.
Two Kohanim, right.
We do in Israel.
Oh, but why not in Chutz La'aretz?
It's Svardim do here in Chutz La'aretz.
Svardim, okay. You know, halavai, we should all be zochar to be Svardim. Oh, so the Rama says, it's a very mysterious statement, but he says that in Eretz Israel, in Chutz La'aretz, we have the Gullus, and we're doing all day is worrying about Parnassa, and you know, and trying to make ends meet. And life is tough. Eretz Israel is the land of happiness. Everything's always better in Eretz Israel. Chutz La'aretz, we can't achieve the same emotional level, that, you know, levarach ha'amo Yisrael ba'ava, it has to be done with a certain enthusiasm, right? So we can't, so the Rambam says a similar thing when it comes to nevuah. In theory, a person could reach that level, but that's what the Gemara is saying over here. Not that Rav Huna, because he lived in Bavel, so he was disadvantaged inherently, but because the nature of Galus is such that, after all, you know, the communication from HaKadosh Baruch Hu is, it corresponds to a person's level of simcha. That's why we find also in the Nevi'im, right, the students of the Nevi'im who wanted to reach the level of Nevuah, what were they always doing? Playing instruments.
Music.
Right? They played music.
The origins of our religion are based on Nevuah's outside of Eretz Yisrael.
Oh, okay.
Abram to Moshe.
Great. Beautiful kasha. The Achron only asked that kasha. Okay. So someone give an answer. How come the Gemara doesn't say, what about, the Gemara only asked about Yecheskel. What about Moshe Rabbeinu? He was getting the best Nevuah ever, left and right, Har Sinai.
And the Yonah in the fish.
Oh, okay. So Yonah's a kasha, but Yonah, as I said, he started in Eretz Yisrael. So Yonah might have the same answer as Yecheskel. But what about Moshe Rabbeinu?
The fish was in the sea.
Avram Avinu. Okay. Avram Avinu. It is a question as to when exactly Hashem spoke to Avram first. The Lech Lecha was, he was definitely, you're right. It's a good kasha. But Moshe Rabbeinu is even stronger kasha.
Yeah, that's
what's that? Okay, so in the Midbar, similar question, right? Okay, so you can ask the same question. Anyone who was pre-Eretz Yisrael, right?
Yaakov in Padan Aram,
right?
Okay, but again, Yaakov started out in Israel. That's what I'm saying about the... So the answer is something very simple. Eretz Yisrael has its status, unquestionably. But only once it had its status was it to the exclusion of all other lands. Before the Jews came to Eretz Yisrael and gave it the full-fledged Kedusha of the promised land, you know, that we finally made it. So then it took on that, you know, place in the hierarchy. There's a few examples. I'll give you one example. The Gemara says, there are three reasons why we don't say Halal on Purim. What are the three reasons? You know, I'm telling you, you know the answers.
Oh, well,
there's no Halal on Purim, right? Why not?
One answer is
the Megillah itself is a Halal. Number two, it took place. Okay, so keep in mind that. The third one is Akati Abdi Achashverosh. We were still subservient to Achashverosh. Let's think about that question. The second answer. Second answer was it took place out of Eretz Yisrael. So did Yetzias Mitzrayim. The second answer of the Gemara is that we don't say Halal on Purim because the miracle happened in Chutz La'aretz. Okay? But so did Yetzias Mitzrayim. Right? What about Pesach? It also happened. So the answer is, but that was before we came there in the first place. Once Eretz Yisrael, once we arrived there, then it got that unique status and it could never be, you know, traded off to anywhere else other than Eretz Yisrael. So we were in Eretz Yisrael, we went to Gullus and we're in Persia and the story of Purim. Too late. Once Eretz Yisrael got that special status, a miracle outside of Eretz Yisrael just doesn't make the cut. Likewise, the Nevuah, once we had entered Eretz Yisrael, is on a different plane. And then if you're outside of Eretz Yisrael, you can't get the same Nevuah. Okay, so that's the answer to your question.
That may apply to Jews, but how about Bilam?
But that was also pre-Eretz Yisrael. Bilam was before we got there. So it's the same thing as Moshe Rabbeinu. Right? Okay, we got to cover some ground, otherwise I'm going to get kicked under the table, just like in the Gemara. Okay, we're about 3-4 lines up from the Y lines. Keskula Hasam, yeah. Oh, I didn't get to tell you what Rav Kook says about that. All right, we'll talk later. All right. A school of Hassam. So they finally they got him out of his house. They got him out of town, and he was on the way to Eretz Yisrael. They were taking him from Bavel to be buried in Eretz Yisrael. Amr le Rabbi Ami Ravasi. Rabbi Ami and Ravasi were in Eretz Yisrael, and they said to themselves, they heard people saying Rav Huna Asi. They were told Rav Huna's on his way. They didn't know that Rav Huna had died. They just heard that he was on his way. Amru, they said to each other, Kiavin and Hassam, when we were in Bavel and Yeshiva, Lo Havalan Ledluya Rashan Mine, we couldn't even lift our head to him. You know, we were too embarrassed, too ashamed to go visit him and learn from him because we weren't on the level. Hashtra Sinan Hacha, Asabasrain. Now we came to Eretz Yisrael. He's coming after us. Let's take advantage of the opportunity to learn by him. Amru Le, they told him not so fast. Aronoba. It's not Rav Huna, it's the Aron of Rav Huna. And Nebuch, he passed away. You missed your chance. I think there's a little bit of a musr there. I once asked a question to Rav Schechter, and he didn't have, the answer he gave me was somewhat, he said it was a little bit wishy-washy. He said, I think we asked this to the Rav, and I don't remember exactly what he told us. And he started crying. He said, how could it be I didn't take advantage of the opportunity to fully take, and this is someone who with, you know, with photographic memory knows everything that the Rav said. But the little bit that he felt he didn't, you know, fully internalize, he cried. He literally cried in front of my face.
He cried easily. He got very emotional. I see him do that.
I don't think he cries easily. I think we don't cry easily enough. Okay. Continues the Gemara. So now Aronobo, Rabbi Amir, Rav Asi, Nafuk, Rav Ila, Rav Chanina, lo Nafuk. So some of the Rabbanim went out to greet the Aron and join the procession, and others didn't. Iga de Amri, Rabbi Ila, Nafuk, Rav Chanina, lo Nafuk. And there was another version where it was flipped. The other Amorayim stayed inside, and now the remaining ones went out to greet the Aron. So de Nafuk, my time, eh? Why would some of them opt to go to meet the Aron? De Sanya, because there's a brisa that says, Aron ha'over me'makom le'makom, a coffin, a casket that's going from one place to another. You're supposed to go out when you know that it's passing, stand in the street, and you know a shura like we do following a burial via. So you know you let the arm pass, and there's brachos that you would bestow upon the avelim. Tanchumi avelim, right? You say makom menachem eschem. The lo nafuk my time up, but why were there some who decided not to go outside? Desanya, because they learned the brisa, aron over me makom lamakom, an aron that's passing from place to place, ain't om de malav b'shura. They ain't om de malav b'rachas aveilam, v'ten chumi aveilam. You don't form that lineup. You don't recite all the consolation, the brachos. So kasha nadadi, these two brisas seem to contradict each other. Lo kasha. First word on the fourth white line. Kan sheshildo kayemes, kan b'she'ein sheldo kayemes. It depends. Is shildo kayemis, is the skeleton, is the spine fully intact or not? If it is, then we offer the full extent of the kavod. If not, not. Rav Huna shildo kayemis ava, and Rav Huna, his body was intact. The lo nafek lo siyamu kame, but those who didn't go out, they were not informed. They were under the impression that the body was not fully intact for whatever reason, and that's why they didn't come out to greet the Aron. Okay, end of the story. Rav Huna's body now makes it to Eretz Yisrael, and they have the procession, and we're ready for the kvura. Amri, they asked amongst themselves, Heichin inchi, where will we put him to rest? Where exactly is going to be his burial plot? He clearly did not reserve a makom on Har Zeisim, when it was cheap. Okay, Rav Huna rebates Torah Yisrael. Rav Chia rebates Torah Yisrael. So they said, you know what? Rav Huna had a unique success of spreading Torah in Eretz Yisrael, and so did Rav Chia. So they thought, it would be appropriate because they each one excelled in their own way of spreading Torah, that they should be buried near each other. So the Ran and the Ramban point out over here, you see that we make a very calculated effort to determine where a person should be buried. Nowadays, obviously, there's plots and there's a chevra, whatever, but if you go to Har Menuchos, you ever go to Har Menuchos, right near the front, Moshe Feinstein and the Belz Rebbe, you can't get those plots too easily. There is still a very, conspicuous effort to keep tzaddikim with tzaddikim, and not just, good people versus Rishon, but the upper level of tzaddikim, that has to be recognized. The Gemara says in Yavamas, actually, the Gemara, in American society, sometimes in the legal system, someone will be sentenced to 12 consecutive life sentences, right? So, what does that mean exactly? So, a similar thing happens in Yavamas, where a person is guilty of multiple capital punishments, and we threw the book at him. So Gemara says, what difference does it make? Once he's dead, he's dead. So Gemara says, Nafka mina l'kovro bin rishonim gemurim. Someone who is liable for one death penalty cannot be buried together with someone who's liable for two death penalties. We care about these things. It really makes a difference. Parenthetically, I have to say, because this is the old Baba Maisa, if a person has a tattoo, there's no reason why he can't be buried in a Jewish cemetery. This is one of the things that, mythical, that a person who has a tattoo can't be buried in a Jewish cemetery. It's just not true. It's not okay, but it's also not okay to eat a cheeseburger. But, there isn't anything worse about the one. Oh, yeah? Okay, good. All right. That's,
I guess that tattoo doesn't include the
oh, for sure not. For sure not. But I'm saying even if someone voluntarily, got a I love mom, he can still be buried with everyone else.
That's also a tattoo.
That's also, yeah. Of course, that too is a medal of honor. Davar Shebekdusha. Okay, so they were trying to figure out where to bury him, and they said they'll put him with Rav Chia Man Mayalei. So now they said, okay, who's going to be in charge? We don't let anyone carry the coffin, right? Nowadays we're mocked, just not to let the goyim do it, but they wanted to have also the highest level person to be transporting the aron to the kvura. Amar Rav Chaga. Rav Chaga said, Ana Ma'ailon Alei Du Kumte LeTamudai Keavina Bar Tamni Srei Shnin. He said, I should be the one to do it. I'm a Talmud of Rav Huna, And I made a particular, I had particular success in concretizing my learning from the age of 18, when normally people start getting married. I didn't get married, and I had extreme purity. I never had the tumah of Keri. I should be the one to put him in his makom of the kever. Now, by the way, you know, you read a line like this, it seems like he's a little bit boastful about the right. So I have to tell you, you know, there's a story of Moshe Feinstein, Rabbi Tendler, his son-in-law, said this over at the Levaya. He said that Ramosha had heart issues, and they wanted to give him a pacemaker. And he called Rabbi Tendler, who's a doctor, who's a medical expert, you know, to explain to me how it works, what's the procedure, and so forth. Hangs up the phone, calls him back a week later. You know, Moshe, tell me again how this works. Gives him the whole story. Hangs up the phone. Third time, Ramosha finds and called him up and said, "What?" So eventually, Rabbi Tendler said, "Shver, you know, why do you keep asking me? I told you how that works." He said, "This is unbelievable." He said, "I know that if Mashiach comes, they're going to ask me to be a member of the Sanhedrin. And a member of the Sanhedrin is not allowed to have a mum. And therefore, I'm trying to ascertain whether having the procedure to implant the pacemaker will render me a Baal Mum or not." And Ramosha was about 4.5 feet tall and the most humble person. He's soft-spoken, loved every Jew. He was not boastful at all. But he recognized that if he had a task and a mission for Klal Yisrael, then, you know, you got to be honest with yourself and not hold back. To call himself a candidate for the Sanhedrin. Unbelievable. Yes. Only Ramosha. So Rav Chaga said, I'm the man. And I always was close to Rav Huna, and I knew everything he did. I'll tell you a story that no one else would have been familiar with, only me who was so close to him. Yom Achadis Hapchalei Ritzua the Tefillin, B'yosef Ala Arboin Tanisa. One day, the Ritzua of his Tefillin flipped around so that the black part was not facing out, and he fasted 40 fasts. Okay? So it does say in the postgame, even Bizman Hazad, Mishabura quotes that if the Ritzus of your tefillin flip, you should at least give some tzedakah. Okay? But that means the tefillin, it's a discussion about tefillin, but it's primarily the part that goes around the head that actually fastens it to your head. The part that hangs down, that flips all the time, right? So there's two ways to deal with that. Either you can tuck it into your belt, or nowadays, it's become much more popular to you buy ritzuos that are black on both sides. Oh. When I was my bar mitzvah tefillin, you know, it was black on the outside and it was brown on the inside, right? But by the way, there was a scandal a year or two ago. They were lacquering, like putting some sort of plastic coating on top of the. You got to be careful. But either way, the part that's extraneous, that's not actually fastening the tefillin to your head, it's still considered a hiddur mitzvah to always have the black exposed. So you don't have to fast, but if this part, if you know, you at the end of your davening, you feel your head and you're like, oh my gosh, it was flipped. So then at least you should give a little tzedakah, it says in the Mishnah Berurah. Okay, we'll finish off maybe only just a couple more lines. What's that?
Only for the Rosh?
It's a shayla if it applies to the Yad as well, primarily the Rosh, but some say the Yad also. Maybe we'll stop here. I think Okay, do we have a minion for Marv or at least close? Yeah? Okay, good. Wonderful. Yeah.